And Don uncovered one of the largest industrial espionage and financial fraud cases in United States history. It was prosecuted by the U.S. Department of Justice. Don has more than 30 years' experience in the fields of forensic investigations, cybercrime, national security, and information management. He is in PwC's cybercrime and breach response practice. Working with many of the most established and well-known corporate brands, as well as law enforcement and the intelligence community, he's led many cyber breach investigations and advised executive management on breach management strategy and mitigation execution. Don's cyber breach investigative work has been across multiple industries, including financial services, defense, retail, manufacturing, and healthcare. These cyber breach cases include the compromise of regulated personal information, as well as intellectual property, and trade secret theft and fraud. He was trusted advisor to the United States Secrecy Commission, also known as the Moynihan Commission on Protecting and Reducing Government Secrecy. For more than a decade, he worked with the National Security Institute and remains on an advisory board member there. Don appeared on Fox News as a cybercrime and breach analyst. He's the author of two books, and this is one of them, and Don has got copies for you at the end of his talk. This is called Cyber Threat, How to Manage the Growing Risk of Cyber Attack, published by Wiley. And again, Don has thoughtfully brought copies for you all. He's also written the Threat, Managing Risk in a Hostile World. Don.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. And you know, I hope you're not expecting a presentation. I didn't bring one. I have a number of points that over the course of what I assume will be a conversation that I wanted to make, what I really consider trends to be from my perspective and our firm's perspective, and sort of eight key trends that I see, and particularly of interest to board members of both public and private entities. You know, my perspective is shaped largely through what I have gleaned from the intelligence community over time, as well as being in the commercial practice area. So, I'd like to start by saying that there are a couple of really important things that I'd like to convey right up front, and the first one is the regulatory environment. So I'm not by nature a big regulatory advocate, but I think that the circumstances that we see around the data threat and cyber attacks has over the last 20 years shaped my perspective about regulation. And I think there's probably two regulatory bodies which are going to yield greater and greater influence. So if we look at healthcare, we've got Health and Human Services and the Office of Civil Rights looking at electronic medical records. We've got 47 states that have data protection and privacy laws. We've got the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999 governing financial transactions and data protection. We've got the Federal Trade Commission acting in defense of consumers. The one area that has been largely unrepresented has been that of investors and shareholders. So in 2010, Senator Jay Rockefeller began conversations with the chair of the Securities Exchange Commission to present a point of view that all of these other groups or entities have this level of protection, but it's really the investors and shareholders who actually have money at risk. So if you look at consumers, and by the way, I'm not going to mention company names, I'm going to try and not mention countries so I don't get in trouble, but I will tell you that generally speaking, you know, consumers may be inconvenienced, but it is the corporations that may issue them credit cards or other things that are going to get in trouble when there's a data breach, or they're going to have to pay the freight for a data breach. This isn't really the case in the group of investors and shareholders, where there are several things happening there. So the first thing is that boards of directors are going to face increasing scrutiny in terms of these SEC guidance points. And really, it's called the 2011 Cybersecurity Risk Guidance. Now, this has been somewhat, I won't say that it's been dormant, but it hasn't been heavily enforced because the SEC has been trying to hire several thousand enforcement agents with cyber skills and cyber backgrounds. Been largely unsuccessful, is my understanding, and they're trying to do this. So I think that sort of slowed down the enforcement side. But if you're a broker-dealer, or if you sustain a material breach, you have a reporting obligation under this 2011 guidance. The other thing that's important to note about that is that there's an increasing requirement or this guidance, and I use the word guidance very advisedly. We should just refer to it as regulatory requirements, because where there's a material breach, that's what's going to happen. So there's an emphasis now on pre-breach reporting. Now, I will tell you this, if I were engaged by the plaintiff's bar, and this is a conversation we have, I'm the American Bar Association, I chair the Cybercrime Privacy Subcommittee. So this is an issue that we look at on a regular basis. If I or my colleagues were engaged by representing the plaintiff's bar in any sort of litigation against a company, we would be able to go in general, no specific company in mind, but in general, be able to eviscerate the defense that was put up to protect data and to protect the interests of the investors and shareholders. So right now, what the SEC wants is they want the following things to be done on a pre-breach basis so that investors and shareholders understand their risk. And it's generally this. A cyber threat assessment. By the way, let me back up. The reason that this needs to be done for board members is that there's an evolving group of litigation attorneys focused on cyber attacks and how they're going to treat the organizations that whose data is acquired during these cyber attacks. So boards of directors increasingly are going to be held accountable. And I keep participating in law firm panels where the first panel is on the cyber attack and the second panel is on class action litigation strategy. So, you know, I put this trend together after experiencing this for a while. So this is going to happen, and I can tell you that most of the defenses that we see do not necessarily meet the SEC 2011 guidance. And we would be able to go in and illustrate that very clearly. And here's basically what the guidance says. The board should make sure, as part of its, you know, this is not SEC language, this is my language now, but the board's obligations as part of their fiduciary responsibility under corporate governance doctrine should be ensuring that the following is taking place. And this now is in the language of the SEC. Every organization should have a cyber threat assessment. Now, it sounds pretty easy. Pick up the newspaper, you know, hire a consultant to come in for an hour and give you a briefing over lunch. They're looking for a more rigorous cyber threat assessment. They're looking for an assessment that is designed around the interests of an individual company. And it's useful to look at things by industry, but it's not sufficient. And one of the reasons it isn't sufficient is that it depends on where you're doing business and who you're doing business with. That introduces the concept of geopolitical risk and geopolitical cyber threat. And if someone will remind me, because I didn't write it down, at some point I will give you a specific example, a case history of that, where the geopolitical risk involved cyber threat was a potential extreme liability for a client. So the cyber threat assessment. So if you're doing business in 100 countries, you have to look at each one of those 100 countries. You know, so what should you be looking at? Well, you want to be looking at the Transparency International Corruption Index, for one thing. So failure to actually look at, let's say, the corruption index could mean that you're doing business in a country where there's a lot of corruption, where there's unregulated money transmitters are based there, where there's higher levels of transnational organized crime, where government officials are taking bribes, where people are being hired into your organization with a mission to steal what it is that you have. You don't necessarily know, but should know, what treaties are in place between the host nation where your business is based and other nations that they may be doing business with. There's just a wide variety of issues that pertain to threat and risk conditions, which boards often are not looking at and not making the appropriate linkages. An example of linkage, I asked a group of lawyers, mostly generals counsel and CEOs one time, this last year, I said, if I read you a headline, or I'm going to read you a headline out of the Wall Street Journal, and I want you to tell me why you think that might represent an intellectual property and trade secret risk to your companies. And I read the headline. And the headline, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something to the effect of North Atlantic nations seek environmental regulation to improve environment. Now, sounds fairly policy-oriented, governmental, regulatory. What's the big deal, right? And by the way, if anybody wants to throw a guess out there as what the significance is, I'm all ears. But nobody in the room could give me the answer. And the answer is this. The environmental regulations in some deep water port nations has a significant impact on threat and risk conditions from a cyber perspective. And the linkage is this. This is something that boards ought to be talking about. By 2020, 25, 2030, 2050, we see a trend toward increasingly strict environmental regulation. Now, what that means is that if you have a ship coming into a port and it has a carbon footprint of X plus something, and it would exceed the environmental regulations established by that deep water port nation, you might have to pay higher fees for going into that port, or you could potentially be barred from going into that port. So what does that actually have to do with the cyber threat? Well, it has this to do. You want to be able to take a ton of freight. You want to ship it farther using cleaner engines that are based on cleaner technology and using cleaner fuels. So you want to send that freight for the fastest, lowest emission rate and the lowest cost possible. Now, most fleets, if you look at the world's global shipping vessels, you'll find that most of them do not meet this requirement. South Korea's Hyundai Merchant Marine, this is public record, Hyundai Merchant Marine is one of the superior merchant vessel manufacturers using advanced materials, advanced R&D, advanced manufacturing. So there was a cyber attack launched by North Korea. And the cyber attack was engineered to look like, this is all again now, the cyber threat. The cyber attack was engineered to look like it was a political reunification event sponsored by North Korea targeting South Korea. So there were military sites, political sites, advocacy sites that were attacked. So there were, I don't know, maybe a dozen of those sites. The one site that was attacked that was not fitting of any of those categories was Hyundai Merchant Marine. It's sort of like, it's sort of like the giant obvious differentiator. So here we have a merchant vessel manufacturer with political reunification sites. So this is what I refer to as a smokescreen attack, right? So the world's media was focused on the political aspects because it's a very hot topic. But the real goal of this was industrial economic espionage executed through a cyber attack aimed at Hyundai Merchant Marine. So I started looking at this when I saw that there was such an attack, and I said, you know, this doesn't make a lot of sense. So I actually looked into the merchant vessel condition of North Korea. North Korea has approximately 99 shipping vessels that were once detained in Cuba because they were considered to be a threat to local fishing because they thought the ships might sink. So it was a very bad situation. So, you know, what was my takeaway from that? North Korea may have launched the attack, but it was not actually going to use the information to rebuild its shipping industry. You know, that's an uphill battle in the kindest language. So to me, it was only fitting that this could be an operation by China, who does have a sophisticated merchant vessel fleet, who possesses the greatest cyber attack capability in the world, and who, while it denies any formal relationship with cyber attackers in North Korea, actually hosts a North Korean cyber attack squad in the equivalent of a Waldorf Astoria, about 200 miles north of the North Korean border. So I looked further at this, and it was clear that, thank you, it was clear that the northeast region of China that would sit above North Korea and to the west of Russia, which was the industrial area back during the Cold War, when I was looking at the theft of secrets, U.S. technology at that time, this is the new cyber attack center in China. So it just sort of made sense to me that this was a China-backed attack. Now, the reason I mention this is that I think this is an appropriate level of detail for a board to understand so that they can truly understand what the risk is. So you can say, well, you know, are we subject to a cyber attack? Yes, everybody is. Well, how do you defend against that? Well, it depends on a lot of different things. So having that customized cyber threat assessment, I think, is a useful tool to understand what your risk is and therefore how to defend against that. The second part is if you identify each threat, you then need to look at what is each risk that arises from that threat? Is it regulatory, legal, financial, brand, reputation? You identify those threats or those risks associated with each of those threats. Then you want to look at what's the potential, what's the probability that this is going to happen? And you need to do that by looking at a lot of different things associated with your enterprise. Then you look at what is the impact potential. Is the impact potential high, medium, or low? And based on what? And then, for thinking about this from a post-breach perspective, if you imagine that you have been attacked, what are the things that you could have done internally to have diminished the impact or prevented the actual cyber attack? And then you could use that to form a remediation strategy and apply that to your pre-breach environment. Ideally, that's what the SEC would like to see. Now, if you look, is that being done today? It's being done in some places some of the time, but it's not being done in a rigorous way. From what I see, approximately 1 in 5 boards are really looking at these cyber threat, cyber attack issues in a serious way. Now, that number goes up every day. And the reason the number goes up, it's not going up fast enough, but the reason it goes up is that people are becoming more aware of this. Now, that's a concern too, because if you think you know what a cyber attack is, you've probably gained that understanding from reading the newspapers. Right? Well, most of the cyber attacks that occur are never going to be in the press. They're going to be about social security numbers, electronic medical records. There's going to be certain countries and certain criminal organizations that are stealing certain information to do certain things to make money. The actually more egregious attacks are the ones that you will never see unless they get reported as a material breach through the SEC. These are the industrial espionage cases where we're, you know, when you lose an electronic medical record, it's a bad thing. When you lose a social security number, it's a bad thing. When you lose a piece of intellectual property, that you or your organization may have invested in, or individuals may have invested in, you potentially lose revenue, you lose profit, you lose growth opportunity, you lose tax revenue. Entitlements usually suffer. Money has to come from somewhere else. I mean, there are all sorts of lingering liabilities associated with this. So you need to understand how all of these things fit into that threat and risk model. And you know, the other thing I think is important to bear in mind is that we have an evolving cyber attack capability among a number of nations. And what does that mean? Well, that means that there, if we look at our damage historically, we've seen a lot of first party damage where we have an environment, somebody attacks it, they cause damage to our environment. It is clear to me that we are moving toward a new generation of attacks that third party liability is going to be a significant issue. And here's why I think that's going to happen. Anybody here familiar with the cyber attack of a German steel company in 2014? It was a very interesting attack. I read about this while I was actually on vacation in Florida on like December 23rd or something. And I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and it says German steel company attacked. And that was the headline. So, you know, unless you were probably in that business, you might not care about this attack. But it was significant for this reason. It is believed that an employee in December of 2014 sent an email, a former employee sent an email to a colleague that had a virus attached to it. And basically, when the employee clicked on the link, it downloaded a piece of malware into the environment that opened up the security infrastructure of the company. And that was significant because nobody was required to be at the steel manufacturing plant over the holidays. Everybody had Christmas off. So the hacker was able to go into this Internet of Things platform, adjust the temperature settings on the industrial ovens, turn them up to the maximum level, and, you know, I don't know if it was 24 or 36 hours later, whatever, once that sustained temperature had been met, and the maximum sustained temperature had been met, the ovens blew up. So I had a meeting last year with the general counsel of a large global steel manufacturer, and they said this was their number one concern, the CEO and the general counsel. Number one concern, because we looked at a risk assessment that said, what's the one thing that could happen, the sort of one extraordinary event that could put you out of business? And the determination was that a large competitor nation state with advanced cyber attack skills, again, I'm not mentioning any countries here, I hope not to, could launch an industrial sabotage attack against this large steel company and destroy their global position. That could happen. And they did not have an adequate defense to resist that attack. And why? Why wouldn't they have that? It was very hard to do. It was very hard to get. First of all, you have to understand what the threat is before you can protect against it. You know, the other thing is that none of this is cheap. And it's very difficult sometimes to justify, in the absence of significant knowledge, why you should make this investment and how should you defend against these types of attacks. But I'll tell you this, you know, in my experience, every dollar that you spend to defend a piece of data, a transnational organized crime group or a wealthy nation state will spend a dollar plus whatever they need to if they think they need what you have. So that drives up your risk. So the more advanced your product and your knowledge, and the more sophisticated your industry, and the more it depends on sophisticated technology, the higher your risk. And that's become pretty clear to me. On the regulatory piece of this, yeah, I'm sorry, Mike?
You were outlining before kind of vulnerable areas. You started off mentioning health data and financial data, but clearly the area that we're about to segue into is this so-called Internet of Things. And the risk of a manufacturer of these devices that can connect to the internet seems to go up quickly and exponentially. As I was sitting back here wondering about the whole issue of protecting email.
Mm-hmm.
And we all talk about protecting our home computers, but the internet service provider is obviously in a better position to run the kind of software you and I were talking about before the meeting, to screen everything that passes through their servers and to early on detect and deal with, rather than have it be a cottage industry, everybody mm-hmm. taking care of their own problem. And that model problem is the one that then replicates itself in this Internet of Things, whether it's a pacemaker, your automobile, or what have you. It's now connected to the internet.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's appropriate to think of every cyber attack as an economic attack. It's all about money. It doesn't matter who's doing it, unless you're some teenager out there and you want to bring down AOL, which did happen. But, you know, the current culture of the cyber attack is that it's an economic action intended to bring financial gain to somebody else with financial loss of the attack victim. The Internet of Things is particularly interesting, and this is where the third-party risk evolves. So I get lots of questions now from boards and from executive management that, okay, we've got a platform that, I'll give you an example without naming the industry, because it's a relatively small industry and I don't want to identify the client. But let's say that you had a product, a technological product and service that you wanted to deploy globally to a global organization. Maybe it's a global restaurant chain, maybe it's a global hotel, something else. But you build a custom Internet of Things platform for which you provide your customers globally things on maintenance, mean time between failure of parts, maybe financial usage data based on how much energy you're using. I mean, you know, anything that you would use to analyze your business success, right? What if you failed to adequately protect that? Could be a cardiology platform, could be something for steel, could be pharmaceuticals, doesn't matter. Somebody gains access to that platform and then causes harm to those using that platform across the world. That's where this sort of lingering liability issue always comes up. And so as we look at the attack sophistication today, and we look at the, I would say, the inadequate defenses, there's going to be a lot of liability. You remember at the beginning I talked about these litigation attorneys and the class action lawsuits, these seminars, I mean, and it's amazing to see how many people actually show up for this. But everybody smells the blood in the water. So, and this is starting to happen. And I will use as an example, one particular case. Everybody in here knows the company. It was a retail company that was breached. I'm not going to name it. If I wasn't doing a podcast, I would name it, private setting. But you all know the company out in the Midwest, the big retailer that was hit. So I will give you an example of one question that could have been asked that would have likely reduced the impact or perhaps have prevented this. This could have been a board level discussion, at least an executive management discussion. So that particular brand went into the grocery business, as you all recall. When you go to the stores there now, you can buy frozen goods, produce, whatever. You can get everything from a can of beans to a fresh flour, right? The commonality of all of that is the following. That was something that company had never engaged in as a line of business. So that was one thing. The second thing was, it all, usually, most of it, the can of beans may not, the flowers do, requires coolant, some sort of refrigeration process. So I would have asked the question, if I were the chief risk officer for that company, I would have asked this question. Okay, we're getting into a new line of business here. We've never done this before. You look at our heavily regulated environment out here, point of sale systems, payment card industry, regulatory compliance, protections against credit card theft, all of this. We're getting into a new area of business. Who should we talk to, and what questions should we ask about, does this introduce any new risk to our business? Because this is the business we don't understand. It's a business we've never done. So if they had asked those questions, what would the questions have been? Well, one of the questions would be, okay, we don't currently have the measurement of a refrigeration process in our environment. Does that introduce any new risk? If they'd asked the right person, the answer would be yes, because the vendor or the vendors that we can select from are unregulated. They don't do payment systems. They have no experience with dealing with credit card point of sale systems. They deal with the flow of a refrigerant from this point to these multiple points in the store, and then we measure it to figure out how much it costs, and then we pay for it. That system was linked to the point of sale device. So now you've got a regulated environment with an unregulated intrusion of continuous information that failed to meet the requirements of the payment card industry. I don't know, maybe somebody should have asked that question. That would have reduced the risk. So understanding this risk, you know, is critical, and asking the right questions and asking the right people the questions. So that was one of the issues I wanted to bring about. What is it that, you know, from a regulatory perspective would be useful in understanding? I want to talk a minute about a few attack trends, you know, that we're seeing. The average attack, cyber attack, takes place now in the point of intrusion versus the point of discovery of that intrusion is somewhere around 200 days. Where certain advanced nation states are involved in that intrusion, it can go up to substantially over a year. 390, 400 days, something like that. So there's a big difference. So the sophistication of the attacker plays a role here. But 200 days is a long time, right? So what happens in those 200 days? Well, it used to be that if your goal was to go in and attack a website and shut it down, you'd know about it right away, right? We're getting calls from customers, the website doesn't work. IT and security reporting, you know, we're offline. That's not, that still happens, by the way. But what as often happens today is that sophisticated attackers will go in, they'll erase their tracks coming into your environment, and they will just very simply sit there and watch and look. Now, you've all seen where W-2s have been compromised and stolen, other tax information. you know, hey, you know, the CEO just sent me a note saying we better pay this $30 million check by the end of the day tomorrow. They're going to shut down our operation. Well, you know, those are obviously, you know, cyber attacks. They're faults. But the people who are making these threats and who are writing these notices have been inside your system for a while. This is not something you just come in and learn over the next 20 minutes, right? So we see these attackers being in the environment and just collecting intelligence. Who's the CFO? Let's see what the name is. Let's see, where does he go? What do his authentication credentials look like? And then by looking at the email, say, well, who does he work with a lot in the organization? So very sophisticated levels of intelligence collection. And just think about it. If you watched an environment every day for 200 days, how much you could get out of it, what you would know. Well, I will tell you that many of the transnational organized crime groups and nation states have very sophisticated business operations that do nothing but collect information and assess how can they utilize that information. I was telling Mike before the meeting today, I had a large bank ask me one time as to whether whether or not I thought they were subject to a significant cyber attack in the relative near future. And we concluded that they were on the basis of the following evidence. We were able to go out and break into a hacker website that had profiles of 10,000 of their employees around the world. And what I'm telling you, it's a sophisticated intelligence collection effort. This is a really good example of it. Basically, what they had was the 10,000 employees were profiled. They had their pictures, their titles, telephone numbers, email addresses, social media passwords. Now, they couldn't actually break the complex passwords that the bank required of the employees. But when the employees went out to social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, or whatever, they used weak passwords because nobody enforced strong passwords. So the organized crime groups were able to break those passwords, and they started a data collection effort. And they collected all this data over a period of time on 10,000 employees. So now they could very easily launch a social media campaign or a phishing attack against these employees. And I'll tell you, of 10,000 employees, I'll guarantee you somebody's going to click on a link that's going to download a virus. It's just like 99.999% true. Jill, you're a physicist. You can give us the statistics. It's probably going to happen, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
10,000 employees.
Yeah, 10,000 employees.
More than once.
Yeah, exactly.
John?
Yes.
I'm sensitive that we have 15 minutes remaining. I want to make sure that people have questions and comments that they can get it. I've got one.
Fire away.
We've got you, and we've got Bruce here from in the insurance world. I am sure that there are insurance products to insure on cyber crimes. How do you underwrite something like that? How do you price a premium?
Now you asked me that question in front of an insurance professional. You answer first, then I'll.
I mean, all of the things you've been talking about are normally that's included in the application process, which has gotten more and more detailed. And that influences clearly the pricing and availability. The products are actually interesting. They're actually pretty good right now, but that's because the claims haven't started to pour in.
Yeah. It's also a challenge that you may be recovering some monetary damage, but you're not getting back the Social Security number.
No.
Which is ultimately the problem.
Or your trade secret.
Exactly. So it's a nice band-aid that makes it looks good, but you really need to solve the problem first and then do the insurance.
Well, I mean, you're talking about really what we call loss control. I mean, the things that you do up front, it's always better to avoid loss.
You precipitate that, I guess, by making them fill out that application and then they realize they've got a hole.
There's a lot of pretty good websites that will actually take for smaller companies that will take you through all of the things that they are talking about. You know, what are your protocols? What are the things you should be thinking about? You know, what are the pre-loss things? What are the post-loss things? You know, how to manage losses? There's an enormous. We started a wiki site about 2 years ago that catalogs all this stuff, and you know, all of the articles and all of the breaches that are going on. It's actually kind of scary how quickly it got big.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Most cyber insurance policies today cover forensic and legal costs. The cost can be significant. Also covers for, you know, notification costs, regulatory actions, regulatory fines. However, there was a very interesting decision. I think it was a Fifth or Sixth Circuit decision, just in the last week or so. It was mentioned in several publications, where a judge sided with a company who had property and casualty insurance. There was an attack, a cyber attack, and the courts ruled that property and casualty insurance would have to cover the cyber losses. Now, that's pretty significant when you think about that in terms of the Internet of Things platform, because that now means that if you suffer property and casualty damage or loss of life, which is, you know, which is going to happen, because it doesn't have to be a steel factory, it could be a smart office building, right? So when that happens, does that mean that you don't need cyber insurance? Does that mean that it's going to be cyber trigger insurance? So it wasn't a cyber event that caused damage, but the event resulted, you know, from a cyber relationship, an adversarial cyber relationship. So did you have cyber trigger insurance? Did you have a cyber policy to cover the forensics, legal, and regulatory costs? Or will your property and casualty policy now have to pay for that where there's any continuing damage?
A couple of things about that. You can buy in a cyber policy the extortion coverage, but you also can buy, if your network gets compromised, and it covers your business interruption for that.
Yeah, business interruption. Part of your
but you also can buy it on the, there is the capability on the property side, you can even buy contingent business interruption, so if you have a primary supplier. But the drill down gets, it's quite detailed.
Well, I mean, we've worked on a number of these where we're answering hundreds of pages of questions, you know, for large clients that want to be able to acquire cyber insurance. So the going back to the SEC real quick, the SEC advocates several things. That you, number one, have cyber insurance to offset a potential cost to your investors and shareholders. That's number one. Second thing is third-party vendors. So if there's an attack, chances are there's going to be a third-party vendor involved, right? So what are you requiring of your third-party vendors? So this is probably one of the biggest risks that any company will have, where you need to adequately, you know, make sure they have adequate cyber insurance coverage, because they may not be able to cover your losses. Yes, sir, you got a question.
Well, you're talking about the third-party vendors. I work with a law firm, and it's the understanding that there's been some research that said that for a lot of these big banks, the big holes in their security are not in the bank itself, it's within these third-party organizations. And law firms know all the secrets. And so if you're in one of those industries, getting your cyber security in order may not just be a good idea for you, but it may make it so that you can have access to different clients, because clients are now requiring that law firms and related organizations have the same type of security as they are required to have.
That's absolutely right.
Panama papers.
Yeah.
The burden of proof on that, though, you know, when you talk about the pre-breach activities and that cyber threat assessment, what is the reasonable standard that a board can implement to say, not only are we doing this, but we're testing and auditing? The last company I ran, we got data feeds from the large health carriers. It's all PHI.
Yeah.
It's no secret that one of the Blues, their affiliates, had two different data breaches. Mm-hmm. It was tracked down to one sovereign and one third party where the weakness was. What is the prudent activity that the board can say, we've done something? Is that a SOC 2, SOC 3, the old SSA 16? What is the standard that you can say, at least we're holding ourselves and our partners accountable for?
Yeah, that's really a great question. And the answer, I'll try and do justice in the answer, all right? So you should use one or more standards to meet from a cyber and information security point of view. Whether it's a NIST standard, you know, whatever, ISO standard, you know, you should adopt those as standards, right? So you want to make sure from a security point of view that you've done that. But a lot of this is not just about security, it's about managing risk, right? So you want to make sure that whatever deficiencies you may have had in your security systems, and everybody has them, nobody can protect all of their information all of the time. It is physically and virtually and digitally impossible. You can't spend enough money to protect everything equally, right? So you have to manage your risk. So I think the following is important. I think making sure, so you look at what are you subject to in terms of the threats. You need to understand the things that the SEC was talking about, but in addition to that, or as part of that integrated model, you need to be thinking about how do you manage the third-party vendors? Do they have the cyber insurance? But also, are you putting a burden on the third-party vendors that in the event of a breach, they accept that liability and they indemnify you, all right? So that's number one. The second thing is, in your master service agreements, in your SLA, your service level agreements, what are they doing to manage? By the way, I have a chapter on this in my last book. What are the third-party vendors required to do by you in order to understand what is their breach environment? Here's a question I did. It was one of the largest companies in America. Had a breach, happened numerous times, and I went back, and it happened through a third party, and I said, did you ask the third party, when you signed the latest agreement with them, if they had done due diligence about their own breach environment and their own breaches that your third-party vendor sustained? And the general counsel said, no. I said, going forward, be a good thing to start with. Have you, as a third-party vendor, experienced any breaches? Yes or no? If the answer is no, verify it. If the answer is yes, drill down. In this particular case, not only had they had multiple data breaches, they had breached the data of over 7 million different people and actually had a group operating internally committing debit card fraud with a major state for a child welfare program. None of this was known to my client. So you want to manage the risk through the deployment of security and regulatory compliance. And all that's important, but you need to manage the risk through your legal instruments, particularly master service agreements and service level agreements.
We have 5 minutes left.
Quick comment from the vendor perspective, because my company Lifespan was essentially a vendor providing data security services for this end of life IP access. So yes, they would go after it in the SLA. They would also come on site, audit us, and they required us to have third-party certification from NAIDE,
right,
the National Association of Information Destruction, who used to show up unannounced and inspect our facilities. So it was kind of due diligence coming at us.
Yeah, hold vendors to a higher standard.
Exactly.
Yes. Jill?
Yeah.
You're a nuclear physicist. You might bomb us if we don't take your
I'm
question.
Not a nuclear physicist.
Okay. Astrophysicist.
So I worked for a long time in the defense industry. And one of the things that we were often required to do at our most secure facilities is have the data of most concern on systems that, in fact, were not connected to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And you just walled them off. And I have worked with a number of companies where I've talked about that as well. If you're doing internal process, for example, in your steel mill, I think you should be asking the question, why are the control systems for your industrial process connected to the internet? Maybe they don't have to be connected to the internet. And I'm wondering if you still consider that to be a viable strategy. I know we're in the century of the Internet of Things, but there's a lot of things that you're not necessarily going to get a benefit if you connect it to the internet, given the risk that you're going to incur by doing that.
So, I completely agree. There are some things that don't need to be connected to the internet. Convincing companies of that is a major challenge for this reason.
Particularly
IT professionals. I led a 70-country breach investigation last year. We went to 70 different countries and conducted multiple interviews. We listed 900 findings of vulnerabilities that needed to be remediated, and we prioritized those for the client. And in almost every country, we got pushback. Well, you know, the security that you're recommending is going to interfere with productivity. It's going to cost us money.
Not nearly so much as shutting it down well.
Yeah, but they don't get that. They don't get it. And this is why I'm a huge advocate of really sort of creating, you know, a pyramid structure of what data needs to be protected. You can't protect everything. You don't need to protect everything. The things that cause your economic engines to run and provide jobs and employees and, you know, allow you to acquire companies, to make investments, to expand, whatever those things are, that's what needs to be at the top of the pyramid to protect. You know, social security numbers, electronic medical records, these are all things that belong in that top tier. But we see people storing tremendous amounts of information and trying to secure it. It doesn't need to be secure. May not even need to be storing it, right? But productivity is an issue, and I've had numerous CEOs tell me, if we do what you're suggesting, we might as well get out of business because we can't operate profitably that way. And my comeback is, then you're not managing your risk adequately. Well, we can show you how to do that. And so it is possible to do, but it requires a new way of thinking about the problem and then a new way of thinking about the solution.
We have time for one more question.
I just want to finish with another question because...
All right, Jill and then
Craig.
The other question that I had, because I have two questions, is really about human security. So you can do all the system stuff in the world that you want, but you can have an employee that's compromised.
Mm-hmm.
You can have internal fraud going on. You can have an employee that's compromised by a foreign country. After all, we have people here with all kinds of nationality and nationality alliances,
mm-hmm.
as does Europe and the rest of the world. So if you also don't handle the human security the best way you can, I don't care what you've done to your systems.
There is no security without human security.
Right.
I've never yet met the computer that came in and invented itself and launched an attack without human intervention. So yeah, absolutely.
So I'm assuming you include that in your risk assessments when you're looking at these companies.
You know, the development of these master service agreements and service level agreements are between human entities, right? And they are trying to exert control over technological environments, but it's all negotiated by humans. So yes, absolutely. And then, you know, profiling. You know, people always tell me, well, we can't profile people. Well, why don't you just analyze their behavior patterns then? It's the same thing, right? I mean, but, you know, calling it profiling, you know, people get upset.
Criminal background checks,
yeah.
Always had, you know, all important.
Right. You know,
I
had a case 2 years ago of a company that hired an individual who brought in five of her friends to take credit card numbers over the phone. When you looked at the TV and saw the 800 number, except her five friends didn't exist. She gave them all social security numbers of deceased people, gave them addresses, telephone numbers. They just didn't exist, right? So, you know, there's a lot of reality out there that is surreality, but people don't do the right background checks. By the way, every one of these five people passed a background investigation. Everyone that didn't exist, they all passed a background investigation.
Craig's got the last question.
Don, you've been in front of a lot of boards, and putting aside the planning and the extortion, et cetera, what can we learn from some of the mistakes you've seen boards make when they have short time and they have to make a decision soon? It's not long planning cycle. I mean, extortion, wrong decision on extortion sounds like an example. What else have you seen where you walked away and said, we shouldn't have done that?
Okay, I'll give you a very specific example of a CEO who lost his job. As a result of this, a CEO of a multi-billion dollar manufacturer in the Northeast decided to convince the board to vote down an information technology system upgrade. The upgrade would have provided better security. And this is just one example, but they voted it down, so the security system in place was not equal to the current threat environment at that time. 4 years prior to my understanding of the understanding that there was an intrusion, there was an intrusion 48 months prior to the discovery of the breach, which we discovered. And a lot of damage was done. It was $100 million extortion. There were multiple nation states involved. There was the development of an investment website used to scam high net worth investors. And that model that was developed was franchised by a transnational organized crime model and franchised to 99 other criminal groups around the world. That resulted in $100 million extortion through ISPs, by the way. ISPs were the sort of neutral environment, but the ISPs would not agree to take down any of the content on this investment website. So, I don't know if you've ever heard of Liberty Reserve, but it was an $8 billion money laundering operation. When you went into this website and they used the CEO's picture, his name, and his company's name that purportedly were promoting this investment, and when you went in and you clicked on Invest Now, it took you to a website where you could put your bank account number, wire transfer, credit card number, which a number of people did, but it turned out to be this unregulated money launderer operating out of Costa Rica. So now they had all of your information and they could launch separate scams against each potential investor that signed on And they were shut down in May of 2013 through a lot of international investigation led in the United States by the FBI. Okay.
I think we're going to have to stop at this point. I'd like to thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Don has been kind enough to bring copies of his book, and
I brought 20 copies. So I don't know how many people are here.
Let me just pass them around.
But if you don't get one, if you send me an email, I'll make sure that you get one.
If you'd like to have Don sign it, please.
The books are free. I have $50 signature.
Well, then I'll sign it for you.
I'm sorry? July 2014.